From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. My great thanks to Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance, for stepping in to host this program last week. This year, State of Belief is celebrating 15 years of weekly broadcasts from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. So much of that work has only been possible thanks to the generous support of our listeners. Now, if you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com, stateofbelief.com. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, because pandering knows no season, two states have already advanced anti-LGBTQI plus pieces of legislation. Mississippi legislators found time to focus on excluding transgender students from sports, while South Dakota is abusing religious freedom language in a blatant attempt to enshrine discrimination in law. This underscores, yet again, how important federal legislation is in providing basic protections for all Americans. So it is worth celebrating the passage this week of the Equality Act by the House of Representatives. Powerful anti-gay forces are spending millions in attacking this morally driven legislation. So it's important for all people of goodwill to engage in the process as the Senate takes up the bill. And as if we need any more evidence of how far the anti-democratic political religious right has drifted from reality, the $1 Million Family Research Council is obsessively condemning the barricade still surrounding our nation's Capitol building, even as the Capitol Police are urgently warning of ongoing credible threats from the kind of far-right extremists the FRC endlessly stokes. As ever, friends, when you mix religion with politics, what you get is politics. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
How's it going, CPAC? Or I heard someone earlier phrase it a little bit better. TPAC. It's what it feels like, guys.
In a different age, you might almost think that the past 4 years and the subsequent electoral defeat might encourage some reflection and reevaluation. If what we saw at last weekend's Conservative Political Action Conference is any indication, however, that's not what's happening. Peter Montgomery of People for the American Way will be back to evaluate what was said and what wasn't.
Each of us in our own way, while we watch for the action of God, we can resolve to do what we can do to bring us through the crisis time towards a new normality in which racism, white supremacy ideology, begin to be things of the past, and a new freedom emerges for all of us.
For many years, the Reverend James Forbes Jr. has been the busy leader of the Healing of the Nations Foundation. As we look at the daunting task of healing our own nation, Jim will be back with us to share some of the insights he's gleaned in his work on reconciliation and reengagement in the face of seemingly insurmountable odds. But first,
the first publicans migrant kids might be taken from their parents came in the first months of the Trump administration.
Are you, the Department of Homeland Security, considering a new initiative that would separate children from their parents if they try to enter the United States illegally?
I am considering exactly that.
It was an especially dark aspect of a very dark time for our nation. Under a savage zero-tolerance policy that trampled, among other things, the legal and moral precedents of American refugee policies, the previous administration separated thousands of children and infants from their families at our southern border in all of our names, with no plan to ever reunite them, despite publicly ending the practice in the face of deafening outcry in 2018, we now know, in fact, that it continued for months after that. There are few areas of public policy where the shift from then and now has been as abrupt. In its first month, an interagency task force named by the Biden administration has succeeded in reuniting over 100 children with their desperate parents. But this is just the tip of an iceberg of bad policy that needs to be permanently thawed. I am delighted to be joined now by Bishop Minerva Carcano, a leading voice on the ethical and religious mandate for caring for the displaced and the desperate. Bishop Carcano, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
You and I have talked on this show and at other places, too, about some of the outrageous and inhumane policies the previous administration has put in place. Are you happy with how the Biden-Harris administration has addressed these issues so far?
I am pleased, but I believe that we're going to have to all step up in support of what the Biden administration is bringing forth, because it comes on the heels of 4 years that dismantled so much of the goodwill, so much of the conviction of the majority of the people in this country to support policies around immigration that are just and fair, that support families, that recognize the fact that immigrants support our communities, that they are us. And so that will not be an easy task. Somewhere along the line recently in conversation, someone who's closer to policy work said to me, you do know that the Trump administration undermined, changed, fooled with about 400 policy matters. So to look at 400 policy changes, anti-immigrant, and I believe anti-American policy changes, to look at those to rebuild from this awful base will take all of us. Our voices need to be heard. There's too much of the racist, the white supremacy voices, the nationalism voices that are not U.S. They're not American in spirit. They're certainly not from a place of faith, whether Christian or otherwise. And so it is a good moment. We believe it is a good moment. I just heard an interview with a migrant who is still in one of those camps along the border down in Matamoros, Brownsville border sector, who said, I'm grateful. Even now, I want to thank President Biden for his work. He has a lot of work to do because of the scourge of the Trump administration. I believe he speaks for all of us.
Sure. Well, what areas of concern would you like to see more urgent focus on?
Well, certainly to look at the immigration situation comprehensively and not piecemeal it. This is the moment to look at it comprehensively. So to look at that pathway to citizenship, the reunification of families, the protection of the rights of migrants, due process. Our immigration court system is totally undermined, backlogged, needs reinforcement. All of those things are critical. I am right now, most concerned about the reunification of those children. I'm aghast with so many others of us at what we have done to children. It was not just under the Trump administration that children were separated and detained and put into the most decrepit circumstances. It was happening even under the Obama administration. We need to confess that, all of us, and we need to care for these children immediately. The world is looking upon us, and by that I mean the children of the world are looking upon us. I remember not that long ago being in Panama and a young child asking me where I was from, knowing that I'm a brown woman, Hispanic, and I said, I'm from the United States. And he said to me, aren't you afraid? Aren't you afraid? This is a child. This is what we're doing to children. And this is certainly what we've done to children in the last 4 years. We need to work on that. We need to quit acting as if we can do this and get away with it, that we can do this and no one sees it, that we can do this and be disrespectful of our commitment to global laws, global commitments to justice, like the United Nations' own convention on the right of the child. We've got to get reconnected with reality and with our values, our virtues, and the fact that we live connected to the rest of the world and are witness to children.
What would you say about the process that we're seeing right now?
I think it is moving in the right direction. I am concerned that already I'm hearing that there are some last minute agreements, adjustments to the Biden immigration bill that is coming forth. Last minute adjustments to give ICE some latitude on what they do, for example. And I just want to say, President Biden, don't go there. Don't go there. Stay strong. Be firm. We stand with you.
It's impossible for our immigration policies, among others, to swing wildly back and forth with every change of administration. What steps need to be taken to ensure the millions of people deeply impacted by these policies are not at the mercy of executive orders?
I'm just learning about the No Ban Act. And I think as I learn, I think that's the kind of step that we need to bring forward. The No Ban Act would not allow presidents through executive order to just say, I'm going to cut off the entry of people like Muslims, people from that faith tradition. I think we need to examine those kinds of areas and agree to some laws that cannot easily be changed by the whim of the next president, because we've just been through one who acted from whim and acted from his own immoral way of viewing the world and viewing others.
I wanted to ask you about the impact of the COVID pandemic on the uprooted communities that you work with so closely. What are the special concerns that arise on top of what each of us is already dealing with?
I want to start by saying that, unfortunately, shelter in place because of COVID has limited how much people of goodwill, people of great compassion, people who've been advocating for the undocumented immigrant. It really has limited what we can do. We've had to find other creative ways to be present. There have been some brave souls who, with masks and all the other safety protocol, have continued to go to those camps where migrants find themselves, have gone to those families who are also sheltering in place and living this moment all alone. So I want to name that. We need to keep working to adapt to the moment so we don't lose the good work that we are committed to do in partnership and relationship with our migrant brothers and sisters. The second thing I would say is that in the conversation about caring for one another, there has not been a conversation about who cares for the migrant, who cares for the undocumented person, except in rare places. For example, as we wait to see if there's going to be another movement towards providing funding to help families and help individuals, there's no funding for undocumented persons. An exception I would raise is that in the state of California, funding has been made available to undocumented persons. I'm glad to report that communities of faith have gathered and have developed funding processes to raise money for undocumented families in their neighborhoods, in their communities across their states. So those are good things. The other thing that I would raise is that in this moment of being unaware, busy protecting ourselves, keeping ourselves safe, immigrants, undocumented immigrants, among them farm workers, some documented, some not, they have been the backbone with medical workers and researchers as essential workers in this country. With no support, with no safety equipment, no masks. They've had to figure that out. I know of farm workers personally, undocumented farm workers in the state of California where I'm located, who have been ill with COVID because of no safety help, measurement help, because if they say, I'm ill, they run the risk of getting no pay for the time that they're way ill and possibly even being fired. And so their families are left even in deeper destitution. Mm-hmm. And I know of many undocumented persons who have just not gone to the doctor or the hospital because they don't have health insurance. They're afraid of this broken immigration process. And they're thinking, if I go to the hospital, they're going to turn me into immigration. And many of them have gone at the last minute, and it has been their last minute of life. Mm. Those are some of the realities that have gotten lost that are, for many of us, out of sight and out of mind. And we're going to have to face that if our hearts have any compassion, as we're able to move into the sunlight of this spring and into the summer, we will see that. And I hope that we'll respond to all of that, catch up.
You know, I, like so many other Americans, I am searching for reasons for hope. And so I ask you again to reflect on the new administration. Are you encouraged that the new administration's COVID response really recognizes the needs that you're talking about and the vulnerabilities that you're talking about?
Because I'm from South Texas, I'm very connected to that camp in Matamoros and Brownsville, and supportive of the frontline workers there. And I've just this week viewed a video of hundreds of those asylum seekers at that camp being released and being processed, being allowed to go and be with their family members and their friends who have offered support for them. And as I watched the video, all of them had masks, had their shields on, had their distance, every once in a while breaking the distance to hug somebody who had walked with them. And so in that image, I see both the compassion toward the immigrant coming, the asylum seeker, but also the precautions in this time of COVID. Those immigrant brothers and sisters are just as concerned about getting ill as we are. And everything I've seen and come to know on this journey is that they're trying to take as much precaution as they can, are ready to do what it takes, may need some masks, may need some shields, may need those kinds of help. But that's an image that is giving me hope this day.
Bishop Cocanio, I can't resist getting your reaction to this comment that Stephen Miller, the notorious author of some of the most savage policies in recent American history, made this week on Fox News. He said,
"What we are seeing here is the cruelty and inhumanity of Joe Biden's immigration policies."
When Stephen Miller says that, we must be doing something right.
We are doing something right. I would also mention that he had an outburst of anger, and it reminded me of those stories in Holy Scripture that speak about the demons that often reside within us, who shout out when the presence of God comes near. I'm not saying that Biden is the presence of God. I am saying that when justice in the Spirit of God, in the Spirit of Jesus, for those of us who are Christians, comes near, those demons begin to protest. That's how I experience his way of being and his statements these days.
I know you do a lot of work on poverty. What are the prospects for the new administration addressing that issue in a more humane and responsible way?
I think that the administration will need to look at racial equity, because poverty in this country is defined by racial inequity. And so I know, I'm confident that they are looking at it through that lens. And I just hope that they are consistent on looking at it through that lens. We will never come out of the depth of poverty in this country until we fix what racism and discrimination have done in this country. So my hope is that they will hold on to the racial inequity as a measurement of how much work and what kind of work needs to be done to restore us to that place of abundance that we should be living with in this country and around the globe, because God has provided enough for all of us if we'll share, in equitable, just ways.
What should the average person who is trying to be a good citizen, what should those people be looking at right now that you've talked about today?
They should be mindful of those who are immigrants among them. They should find good ways to reach out to them and ask them directly, personally, how they are doing, what they are dealing with, sharing their own journey with them. This is a wonderful moment to rebuild community, because we have suffered together. And so let's rebuild community. I would also say to stay in touch not only with what federal government is doing, but what is local government doing? What is our local government about in the treatment of our neighbors, immigrants included? We should also be asking, what is my community of faith doing at this moment, and getting connected with that effort from the place of prayer to the place of action. And so those are some of the things that I think are very, very important. I think we all need to be praying about what we've learned in this COVID season. And one of the things that I hear most often is people saying, I've learned that I don't want to be alone. I've learned the value of community. I miss people, even the people I didn't know but by name, but would see every week, because I'd go to the supermarket or to the pharmacy. I missed them. It's a great way to rebuild community all the way across.
What are the priorities that you have in place to focus on in your ministry in the next few months?
Working on joining the voices of our Interfaith Immigration Coalition, Church World Service, and others on being a presence, speaking back to the Biden administration about their work, encouraging them and calling them to account when they begin to back off because of the political pressure. Immigrants have waited too long. Our communities, our churches have waited too long for this to be resolved in a just and humane way. As United Methodists in my area, we are also working on how do we rebuild community in the ways that I've described? How do we open up our churches in new ways that do not segregate us from the communities, but rather unite us, connect us? We're also looking at housing, affordable housing in the state of California is abysmal, and the suffering will continue without adequate housing. And so we're working on examining how to engage in that work. We have properties that we can use to assist with that. And finally, we're working on being anti-racist. We know that we can no longer be just those who advocate for assimilation and acculturation and welcoming. We have to be anti-racist. Racism is at the heart of all the issues we've talked about during this time.
The Right Reverend Minerva Carcano is resident bishop of the San Francisco Episcopal area, providing leadership in the California-Nevada Conference of the United Methodist Church. Her ministry includes a special focus on immigration and interfaith cooperation. Bishop Carcano, I always, after we have a conversation, I feel like I'm a better person just for talking with you, and I am amazed at what all you are doing and what you're telling us, but what you're doing. And I thank you so much for taking time to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. You're so gracious. And I always leave feeling like I have a partner in you and your team and the listeners. And so thank you all. And God bless you all.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, Reverend Dr. Jim Forbes on ways we can be healing our nation. And later, Peter Montgomery on the Conservative Political Action Conference, keeping the Trump dream alive. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Walton Gatton. My good friend, the Reverend Dr. James Forbes, Jr., is Senior Minister Emeritus of the Riverside Church in New York City and serves as President of the Healing of the Nations Foundation. When I called Jim and asked if he would be on with us again, he said, do I need to study to get ready for the conversation that we're going to have? And I said, no. Your life has done that, and that is true. As our own nation faces enormous challenges to healing, I thought it would be invaluable to have Dr. Forbes back with us today to talk with us about what he knows about healing. Jim, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Walton.
You know, the last time we were together on this show was last September. You spoke as passionately and as urgently and as angrily as I've heard you about the powerful ways race and racism continue to divide this country. A few weeks into the new administration, are there any glimmers of hope on that front?
Well, how do you add it up? I think the more I look at things, the more I assume that the kind of mathematics we need would be calculus, because that's very complex. It has multiple functions, etc. Yeah. For an example, even if the attention to COVID and now a new administrative approach gives evidence that we are likely to get the vaccine and all of this, there is still talk about almost fear of naming when the State of the Union is going to be given because there may be plans to do mischief again on that. So let me just say, my mama used to talk about six in one hand and half dozen in another. So for all of the good news, it feels like if you really put forth your effort, you could find some bad news too. But on balance, I have to believe that the manifestation of ugliness on January 6th is likely to make a lot of people embarrassed at the ugliness and not wanting to have it identified with their ethnicity. Well, there are some reports that some groups are beginning to say there's an ugliness that they don't want to be identified with. But I just think in general, don't you imagine that a whole lot of white people that are observing the gross criminality in high places, the duplicity on the congressional level, the hypocrisy. Don't you think a lot of folks say, don't mess up whiteness. I'm white. I mean, I'm not white, but wouldn't they say, I'm white. I don't want to be ugly white. What is it that white people would be embarrassed about being manifested in white community that would make them shame that they're white? What is that? What would that be? What would they be ashamed for their children to hear to be their behavior, their response to democracy, to people who are different from themselves? What would make folks shame anymore?
How important is it to have diverse backgrounds and experiences represented by the people who lead us?
I would say that if you're going to lead people, you do a better job if you have empathy with them, if you know what they're going through, if you know the pressure points that are likely to bring dismay, disappointment. I would imagine it's hard to lead people that you don't know, or at least that you do not have an empathic relationship with.
Jim, it's a cruel truth that simply discussing the realities of institutionalized and individual racism today can trigger some Americans and cause them to sink even more deeply into denial. Is there a way to approach this so that yields maximum benefits? And I'm thinking particularly of the mandate for religion to finally speak the truth in the places where it hasn't.
Well, I think that a positive approach has got to be given a little bit more attention. I mean, the other day I saw on Rachel Maddow's show where some Sikhs were teaching people a dance in Canada.
Saw it too, yes.
Yeah, and I thought, yeah, I had thought about this, I had said, if I had a lot of time to try to improve relationships between blacks and whites, I would do what I did in a sermon. I preached a sermon on the prodigal son, and when it came to the house after he had come back home, there was Jesus says there was singing and dancing. And I asked people, what kind of dancing you think they did? And I said, if you're black Pentecostal, you thought they did shouting. But I said, really, you know what I think they were doing? I think they were doing the electric slide. And I said, that's it. What I should do is I should get jobs preaching in white churches that ended up having my musician there, and that at the end of the service we'd have this this party for the prodigal son, and it includes electric slide, especially since that doesn't mean black men dancing with white women, because people got a thing about that. I think it reflects something of the evils of the past, but I ain't going to bother that now. But wouldn't it be wonderful for blacks and whites to have more time during the electric slide together? That is to say, the reality is that God, who from the beginning wanted to develop the beloved community, knew that if you create a situation where people are enjoying each other, you'd improve their health immeasurably.
You know, I've seen and heard your music and singing in a sermon, but I haven't yet seen the dance, and I'm ready to see that.
If you get me a gig down there, I'll promise to preach Luke 15, and the title would be, This Party is for Everybody.
All right.
Let me tell you, I just want to ask white people all over the nation, y'all, can you imagine, instead of being angry, apprehensive, fearful, scared of us, suppose we just agreed that we're going to treat each other decently and let's just have some fun together? How many white people think it would be more fun if they could have positive and enjoyable experiences with black people than those who think that they will thrive better if they can suppress black votes and black power enough that they don't have to be apprehensive about the loss of their white power, which would give them more satisfaction?
You know, Jim, there is such contempt and hatred at the political extremes in this country. I do believe that the vast majority of people don't feel this deep-seated rage at those with whom they disagree, but there has been no let-up in these feelings constantly being stoked, particularly in social media. What are some ways that we can start seeing people with whom we disagree as more than just enemies?
Well, I think, praise God, I mean, you know, I go for Romans 8:28, all things work together for good. To the COVID-19 has taught us that it doesn't matter whether you like people or whether you don't like them. The chances of our returning to a positive normal is that until we all get the vaccine, we're all imperiled.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that every news network buys that theory. But I think it seems to be pretty strong that this is that COVID-19 is teaching us that there are some things in life which only if we arrange to promote the well-being of all of us will any of us be in good shape for the future. I don't care whether you're Republican and I'm a Democrat, or whether I'm a Pentecostal and you're an Episcopalian, doesn't matter. I don't care what your religion is. Look, let's just decide that we're going to all get the shot, man. Get the shot. Let's all get the vaccine, not because I like you,
but because of self-interest.
Mm.
My prospects of a good life will be greater if I provide for your health as I provide for my own.
You've done such extensive work in areas of conflict and contention. What lessons can help us get to where we need to be?
Well, first of all, why don't we say that you don't have to be a scholar to know that certain data suggests that what brought us out of our ancient animal background before we were civilized, certain things helped us to become a civilized society. Like we discovered that you want to survive, isolation and loneliness are not likely to be as good for you. We have found out that certain kinds of foods you eat are likely to be better for you.
Mm-hmm.
We've discovered that certain exposure to sunlight will help your vitamin D deficiency. That people that have quality relationships long term learn to deal more with stress. So that social interaction, exercise, nutrition, relationships, all these things that help us to deal with stress positively contribute to the quality of our lives. I think they've recently done a study where they had college students take lists of older people, and half of the older people were called daily by the college students, and the other half were not. But they found out that the older people who were called daily by the college students, their mood improved and their prospect for health improved. I think it's like, I think what we need to learn is that God was a pretty good teacher from the very beginning, that there are certain things that contribute to our health and well-being. And you don't have to be a science to know it. We just have to take time to figure out, my goodness, if I don't exercise, my health won't be as well. I won't get any sunshine. If I don't get some vitamin D, my bones won't be strong. Mm-hmm. It is, and also meanness. I wonder if we could get a theory, do a test. Let's get a grant to do a test. Which does meanness compromise your immune system? I think it does.
The ways communities and congregations have leveraged technology has brought people together in new and unexpected ways during these last several months. You've been guest preaching all over the world, from what I see. And are there ways that these new forms of connection might help us overcome some of the self-inflicted divisions that are so damaging to us?
Well, as you will remember, Dr. King used to talk about going through the South, seeing these beautiful churches with their spires to the sky. And he wondered, what do they talk about in those churches? The notion that there are such things we call white churches and black churches. Well, now, through media forced upon us by Zoom methodologies for our worship, white people will get a chance to hear black people.
Mm-hmm.
What I guess I would hope is even after we get past the worst of this pandemic, I want to promote not, you remember the good old Brotherhood Week where black folks would go to white churches and white folks to,
sure.
I would like to make that more of a norm.
Mm.
I mean, hey, what about making it weekly? I remember at Riverside, I did my Space for Grace. Why not let a church make a point that Wednesday night's prayer meeting is a meeting designed for if you've got different ethnicities in your community, where this is the, I call it the World House Service, where as great a diversity as we can find, we build that service around pulling together the more diverse congregations and making it a free setting and making it one where people can talk about their concerns, where they can give their petitions, where they can make their praise reports, as we did at Space for Grace at Riverside Church. I'd like to think that already we have learned through this pandemic that we can relate to each other, and I hope that maybe all the Zooming we've done will make us say, okay, when this virus is over, let's actually get together on a regular basis.
Jim, I know that in your life, mine too, that prayer and action are part of the same fabric. So what, right now, what are you praying for?
I am praying for God to announce from high heaven that racism is over. That's over, y'all. And for God then to move us to be partners with God in helping to create a world where we are one family together. That's really what I'm praying for. And actually, I'm looking for signs that God has already made that announcement and that I am praying to God, Lord, help me to be an effective member of your dream team for bringing about the beloved community.
The Reverend Dr. James Forbes, Jr. is Senior Minister Emeritus of the Riverside Church in New York City and serves as President of the Healing of the Nations Foundation. He is a dear friend. Jim, your wisdom and your insights are so needed right now in particular. Thank you for taking this time to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so very much. I've enjoyed the conversation.
As we've watched our nation take great strides at last in managing the deadly pandemic, as well as re-engaging with the other countries in the world on issues ranging from military security to the climate crisis, it's hard to imagine thoughtful people saying, nah, let's go back to the chaos that ruled our lives and our discourse for the past 4 years. And yet, there's no shortage of disparagement for the president and his age, for the vice president and her background, indeed for anyone and anything not celebrating the cult-like years most of us have just survived, if you know where to look. CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, took place last weekend in Orlando, Florida, and by all reports, it was less Walt Disney World and more Alice Through the Looking Glass. With a look at the proceedings, I'm happy to be joined once again by Peter Montgomery, Senior Fellow at People for the American Way and tireless chronicler of the political religious right. Peter, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me back.
CPAC was the much-anticipated return of Donald Trump to the public spotlight. By all reports, the viewers' numbers were through the roof. So what did those many millions see him say?
they heard him say what he's been saying since the election, which is that he won in a landslide and that the election was stolen from him and that he's not going away. He was there to assert the fact that he is in charge of the Republican Party and the conservative movement.
You know, you have heard these people so many times and for so long. I just have to ask you, what did you feel about what was being said and how it was being said this time?
I think one of the most striking things was how much of the CPAC was devoted to supporting the big lie about the election. I think there were seven different panels or speakers, groups of speakers, promoting Trump's lie that he won the election and that Joe Biden is illegitimate. And this is after we saw that rhetoric, you know, generated the rage that brought us the Capitol insurrection and took people's lives in that violence. And still, you know, most of the Republican Party and most of the conservative movement is not willing to stand up to Trump, not willing to just acknowledge that he lost the election. And I think that is going to be, you know, that's going to continue to fuel a lot of anger and resentment in the months ahead, which is what they're hoping, because they're hoping that is going to keep their people enraged enough to turn out in 2022 and 2024.
Peter, how prominent were the kinds of political religious voices that were impossible to avoid throughout this administration?
You know, they were, it's all suffused with you know, the sense of Trump as kind of not only the bearer of the keys, if you will, but that he is sort of God's guy, and that he was God's guy, and that he defended our religious freedom. You know, one of the other themes of the event was that the Equality Act, which is moving in Congress to add sexual orientation and gender identity to this civil rights laws, is an egregious attack on religious liberty and would mean the end of religious freedom in America. And it's, you know, we heard that kind of apocalyptic rhetoric there. And it's also, you know, intended to fuel fear and outrage among the Christian right part of Trump's base.
Mm. Peter, I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that elections have consequences was not a phrase that was used very, very much. Am I right?
No, not this time. We've certainly heard that in past CPACs. Kind of reminds me, I've thought it would be interesting if there's a way that we could track how often Romans 13:1 was preached at churches after Trump got elected compared to how often it's been preached since Trump lost. For folks who don't know, that's the Bible verse that says, you know, God appoints rulers and nobody is in power if not there by God. And Trump supporters use that all the time to try to silence critics and to try to silence Christian critics of President Trump. But now that Biden's there, they see him as illegitimate, and we don't hear a lot of people saying that God put him in place.
Yeah, yeah. So was the message that Trump was actually re-elected president actually a part of the rhetoric at CPAC?
Absolutely. I mean, let's, you know, they, the folks at CPAC are not so much the ones out there promoting the idea that the military is going to reinstall Trump on March 4th, that the QAnon folks and some of Trump's prophetic people are out there saying, but they're saying that the election was illegitimate, that the courts failed to do their job by not hearing the cases or not ruling in Trump's behalf. And they're and very importantly, they're trying to use that claim, those false claims, to justify tremendous new restrictions on voting that they're trying to push through Republican-controlled state legislatures. Georgia just passed a restrictive law through its House, and states all around the country are now considering shutting down early voting, voting by mail, clamping down on voter registration. So they're using these false claims of a stolen election to make it much easier for them to, in effect, steal future elections by keeping people from voting.
Were there any themes, and if there were themes, that had something to do with anything else other than what the former president was saying? What were those themes?
You know, those themes were that conservatives are being persecuted, that big tech is censoring them. The stated theme of the conference was America uncanceled, because they're, you know, they're one of the big right-wing talking points right now is cancel culture and the supposed you know, conspiracy between big tech and the Democrat Party to silence conservative voices. So that was another major theme. You know, basically the theme that the Biden administration is out to destroy America with socialism. They really want to resist H.R. 1, which is Democrats' voting rights legislation and campaign finance reform legislation that just passed the House, which would be a tool against some of the new restrictions at the states. And so the Republicans are dead set against that as well.
Peter, this is a priceless reminder that many millions of Americans are simply living in an alternate reality, something that we watch being constructed in plain sight, but that nonetheless threatens unity around basic concepts of what is reality itself. Worse, though, this conference was not nearly extreme enough for several almost former and current lawmakers who intend to spend their weekend at the American First Political Action Conference, and they wanted more fire. What was that all about?
Yes, the America First Political Action Conference is a group of organized by far-right activists, a guy named Nick Fuentes, who has a record of anti-Semitism and white nationalism. And, you know, from his perspective, CPAC is not America first enough. And so during last year's CPAC, he hosted his first America's First Political Action Conference. And he had his second one this year. And he claimed to have three times as many people this year around. But it was extremely disturbing that not only did he have former Representative Steve King speaking, he had a current representative, Representative Gosar from Arizona speaking. And there's just no way a member of Congress should be on stage with this guy. Nick Fuentes' keynote speech, which Gosar was there to hear, was all about white nationalism, how this country was founded and built by white people, that there's a new racial caste system being imposed on the country with white people at the bottom. It was all tied up with a sort of very radical Christian nationalism. You know, the speakers were being interrupted with chants of Christ is King, and Nick Fuentes asserting that this is a Christian nation. So kind of all the you know, dangerous trends that we hear from the religious right and the right wing, it's on steroids at this far-right conference. And the fact that there's a sitting member of Congress participating in that was really deeply disturbing. And the next morning, Gosar was speaking at CPAC. So he was a nice bridge there, and nobody at CPAC you know, kept him from speaking.
So, Peter, what does this tell us about the institutional party, no matter how much it may want to be taken seriously?
I think the institutional party is Trump's party. I think the operating principle of the Republican Party as it exists now is what does Donald Trump want? And you see that from, you know, members of Congress, Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, others who once stood up to Trump now are just yes men to him. And that's, you know, with some exceptions, you know, I'll say there's a few brave members of Congress who voted for impeachment, who did not go along with the stolen election claims. And those people, you know, may well be driven out of the party, because Trump and a number of right-wing groups are now out to take revenge. And Trump is very explicitly calling for all of those Republicans to be taken out in primary elections. And so there's a number of Trump is not the only one saying that. Some of the so-called Stop the Steal organizers who promoted the stolen election theories are going around the country now trying to recruit far-right candidates to defeat the few Republicans who were willing to stand up to Trump. So I think it's a very bad sign of where the party is going to be, at least for the foreseeable future.
Peter, you have spent a big part of your life listening to this kind of talk and seeing how these people act. And I just wonder, how would you compare what you heard and saw this year at CPAC from some of the other times that you've been with these people?
You know, I think it's a lot of the similar themes, but just taking a step further. You know, the Democrats' voting rights legislation is really an existential threat meant to keep Republicans from ever getting elected again. The equality legislation for sexual orientation and gender identity is meant to criminalize Christianity and to destroy religious freedom. Now, we've heard those kind of threats before, but they were very urgent now that they don't have the White House and they don't have Congress. So the fear-mongering was ramped up a notch, and then it was all wrapped up in the person of Donald Trump yeah. as the new ruler of the Republican Party, as the person around whom they're going to rally to resist all these encroachments on freedom.
So going forward, Peter, where would you be looking for signs that these nationalistic forces are consolidating power and of what they are likely to be up to?
Well, I think we can look to 2022. We have already started tracking some of the candidates who have thrown their hat in the ring to challenge House Republicans who voted for impeachment or members of Congress who are in Trump's sights because they did not go along with electoral college challenges. And we're going to see the kind of candidates that are being recruited. You know, we also saw signs from state Republican parties who were voting to censure members of Congress who were not sufficiently loyal to Trump. So I think going forward, that's going to be a real sign of what's to come. And, you know, we'll see if members of Republicans in Congress continue to try to use the tight margins in the Senate to block any kind of progress that the Biden administration and congressional Democrats are trying to make on COVID relief, on the minimum wage, on all the other things that people elected Biden to do. We're going to see the Republican Party digging in their heels to try to stop that.
Peter Montgomery is senior fellow at People for the American Way. He writes frequently for rightwingwatch.org and other publications with a focus on the mainstreaming of the political religious right that is putting all of us in danger. Thanks a lot for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Now, please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Take a look at it and write a check. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. that state of belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.